ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. The White Museum in Alberta just opened an exhibition of works by seven celebrated Indigenous artists. It displays what organizers call iconic artwork produced over decades by Daphne Ojig, Alex Janvier, and Joseph Sanchez, among others. We'll hear about that show and talk with some of the artists in this year's IAIA Graduating Seniors Exhibition. We'll hear more about it after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull. Minneapolis police are investigating three shooting incidents that have killed five and wounded two. Most, if not all, the victims are believed to be Native American. Officials have arrested a suspect in a shooting Tuesday night that killed three people in the city's south side. The Minnesota Star Tribune says 34-year-old James Ortley was arrested Thursday, though police say other perpetrators may still be on the loose. Here is Minneapolis' Chief of Police, Brian O'Hara, at a press briefing on the arrest.
The United States Marshal's Office North Star Fugitive Task Force, assisted by FBI SWAT team, executed an arrest warrant on the 1600 block of South 4th Street and arrested James Dwayne Ortley, age 34. This is a significant step forward in what has been an intense and fast-moving investigation into the most violent incident this city has suffered this year.
Ortley's criminal history in Minnesota includes one conviction each for first-degree robbery, second-degree assault, illegal weapons possession, and fleeing police. Minnesota Public Radio reports that at Cedarfield Park, a prayer and drum circle was held Thursday. Dozens attended the event, and local leaders called for an end to the violence. One victim has been identified as 17-year-old Joey Goodwin, regarded as a talented artist. The murders marked the beginning of American Indian Month in Minnesota. A parade and powwow have been canceled. Chief O'Hara calls the shootings outrageous and senseless. Minneapolis police are seeking tips on the shootings that could lead to more arrests. In Southern California, a coalition of Native American tribes, community advocates, and law enforcement are holding their first ever summit to address missing and murdered Indigenous people. Danielle Bush is the program director for MMIP San Diego, which will host the summit this Saturday at the Viejas Casino and Resort. She says one of the breakout sessions will be on human trafficking.
What are the warning signs, red flags of that, and what to do if you or a loved one or you just see someone who might be in that situation, what steps you can take, you know, because we're trying to end that heinous crime in the community.
Another breakout session will be with regional law enforcement.
The goal of that is to educate people about the Savannah Act and about the Feather Alert and what are your rights and how to proceed if you have a missing relative or anything that law enforcement can provide support on and building those relationships.
The final breakout session will be on healing and support services specifically for the tribal community. Bush says the San Diego area is close to the U.S.-Mexican border, which poses challenges.
With our proximity to the border and for other reasons, San Diego is a hot spot for human trafficking. I believe, you know, third in the country. It's up there. It's definitely an issue in the community that we've been trying, you know, a multi-pronged approach to attacking.
Bush says MMIP San Diego hopes to grow its resources, so invites anyone in the Southern California region to reach out and connect with the organization. And the Oglala Sioux tribe based in South Dakota has voted to cancel its annual powwow, rodeo, and fair for 2025. This year's Oglala Nation Wachipi was scheduled for early August. This comes after a shooting at the 2024 event, which killed 57-year-old Tom Thunderhawk August 2nd. Despite concerns from the family of the victim, the powwow continued after Thunderhawk's shooting. This year, the Tribal Council has instead allocated a small fund for each of the nine districts to host local powwows. The event is a major economic driver for the reservation, drawing thousands of tourists from across the nation. You're listening to National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios in Eugene, Oregon.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support provided by First National Bank Alaska, offering a one-solution, tailored approach to meet the financial needs of Alaskans by providing banking services, loans, investments, and more to help shape a brighter tomorrow. Learn more at fnbalaska.com.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Enbridge strives to be a good steward of the environment, a safe operator of essential energy infrastructure, and a good neighbor. More on Enbridge's Indigenous Reconciliation Action Plan at Enbridge.com. Enbridge proudly supports this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Every year, the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe shows their graduating seniors' work. This year's show is called Rooted Voices. It celebrates the achievements of students who have spent their time at the premier institution for Native art, studying and creating art with one another. We'll get a glimpse of that exhibit today through the eyes of students. And a celebrated museum in Banff, Alberta, honors a group of influential Indigenous artists with the exhibition titled The Ancestors Are Talking, Paintings by the Indigenous Seven. It's the first exhibit featuring the art of all seven artists since the 1970s. We are taking note of the renowned history and the promising future of Indigenous art today. You can join us too. We're at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Our first two guests join us from Banff, Alberta. We have Joseph Sanchez. He's an artist and a co-curator of the Ancestors Are Talking exhibition at the White Museum of the Canadian Rockies. He's also a former curator of IAIA's Museum of Contemporary Native Arts. He has Pueblo and Hispanic ancestry from northern New Mexico. Hello, Joseph, and welcome to the show.
Yeah, hello. Glad to be here. Shout out to my family in the White Mountains.
Thank you, Joseph. Also on the show in Banff, we have Dawn Saunders-Dahl. She is the Director of Indigenous Programs and Relationships and Curator for Indigenous Initiatives for the White Museum. She's a member of the Métis Nation of Alberta. Hello, Dawn. Welcome to the show as well.
Hi. Glad to be here.
It's great to have both of you on the show. Joseph, I'm going to begin with you. As an individual, you've been a pioneer of Indigenous and Chicano art, but let's start with you telling our audience about the Indigenous Seven and how your collective efforts influenced the direction of art in Canada.
Yes, in the early 70s, we seven artists banded together in Winnipeg, Manitoba. Under the guidance, I should say, and wisdom of Daphne Ojig, who had a small gallery. And our conversations together created the idea that we should have a corporation because we weren't recognized at all as artists. And we were certainly not in any galleries or the museums in Canada at the time. So it created this moment. The seven of us banded together and became the first corporation of Native artists in Canada.
Now, the exhibition at the White, again, it's titled The Ancestors Are Talking. Joseph, what does this exhibition represent for those who are fortunate enough to see it?
Well, it's going to be on until October 19th, so I hope a lot of people do come out and see it. But The Ancestors Are Talking is a show of my interpretation of the ancestors talking back to me. So I'm the last living, surviving member of this group of artists, and their paintings talk to each other. We spent a lot of time together, and the work has never been shown as that some of the artists lived into their 90s. So this show represents the entire span of their career. Three of the artists had in-person shows in the National Gallery of Canada, So they're very influential. And my idea in the show was to share these conversations, the spirit talk. Basically, it's our spiritual connection. And to me, they always talk to me from spirit world. So they're talking to me now, and I think they help me curate the work, select the work, and be able to share it with the public. Not only the color that talks about healing, I talked about going to multiple dimensions, sharing knowledge and caring for our family, the natural world. These are all kind of the topics in the show. Being a shaman, especially the idea that this is, you know, this was paradise in this world. And we used to be a caring and nurturing people. And over time, things kind of got away. So we're in a crucial time in the world. And I see this show as a message of healing to the entire world, for unity in the world at a time of crisis. And all these artists have painted like that.
Joseph, you shared you're the last surviving member of the Indigenous Seven. Some of these other members, I mean, a lifetime's body of work. I imagine there were a lot of works that you had to go through. How did you go about selecting these specific works for this exhibition? What was that process like?
Well, I've known all the artists and I've worked with the work for such a long time. And the there was actually a show in 2013 called the Seven Show that showcased our work from 1974. And that was the first show that we actually, that never happened in the actual time. So for me, I'm familiar with a lot of the work. And so I just went to the estates of the families, also to some private collectors, and just let the works talk back to me. And those are the works I selected. I feel I was guided by my friends. And this is like an honoring of their work as artists, their work as spiritual people, and their work also that they shared the idea that we wanted to give our work back to our own people, share it with the young people, bring our children, recognize that they are the strength they have as creative people, and not to be overwhelmed by this, you know, basically the colonial society and those kind of rigors of assimilation. But we have a beautiful creative spirit.
Thank you, Joseph. John, I want to talk to you as well. I know that there's a mentorship program for Indigenous artists there at the White Museum, and you also worked with collecting some of the pieces for the exhibit. I'm on the website right now. I see some beautiful paintings, but one of the challenges with a show like this is we really want our listeners to be able to visualize what some of these pieces look like. So talk about your involvement with the process.
Sure. I have been involved in helping Joseph with collecting the artworks. I've gone to Edmonton and Ottawa to help determine which pieces he'd like to have here, as well as reached out to a few other spaces in BC to bring the artworks here. And they're all just incredibly colorful. These were artists who were masters at their with their drawing skills and their color palettes. It's incredible to see. It's a very bright exhibit, and I hope that people can envision like all of these incredible paintings and drawings that we have put together that are just an incredible swirl of color happening all over the museum, which is really, really nice to see.
Yeah,
and
go ahead.
I was just going to talk about the mentorship program if you wanted. The mentorship program is based out of local artists from Sutina, Blackfoot, Stoney Nations, as well as Métis, Suquamish, Tanaha, artists who have been painting murals at the Cave and Basin Historic Site here in Banff since 2022. And last year, Joseph mentored 6 of those artists, and we are inviting all 17 back this fall to work with Joseph in a workshop and be inspired by this exhibit and all these wonderful colors and stories and drawings and paintings that can inspire them to create new works that we hope to show at the museum next year in 2026.
What's the process for being selected as one of these students who's being mentored by Joseph?
They were all artists who have been selected to create murals at the Cave and Basin since 2022. So we have 17 of them who have made murals both at the Cave and Basin site and on the museum, White Museum grounds. So those are the artists who have already been selected through a process that we actually had open calls for artists. So anybody could have applied who were from those local nations. And from that selection is who we've asked to come and be in these workshops.
And so far, what's been the feedback for The Ancestors Are Talking?
There's a lot of excitement and curiosity. I think half of the show have been in with private collections. And I think there's a lot of folks who are curious to see those works that that Joseph described. You know, they've been around for a long time and in people's homes and in their own private spaces. So it's so nice to see them come out and be shared with the public so they can see all these really exciting pieces. And most of the, as Joseph mentioned, the 3 artists who were in the National Gallery, all painted quite large. So we have lots of large pieces, some small drawings. It's a very exciting group of works that have reflected their careers.
Well, Joseph and Dawn, thank you both for getting our conversation kicked off today, talking about this exciting exhibit taking place in Canada, in Banff, Alberta. We're going to talk about some other artistic ventures, some other shows, some other exhibits. We're going to talk about what's going on at IAIA in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And we're also going to talk about an exhibition in Hickory, North Carolina that features art from the Catawba Indian Nation as well. So we've got a great show ahead of you. For those who are listening, and as always, I encourage people to join the conversation. If you're an artist or you're just somebody who really appreciates great Native and Indigenous art, or maybe you're planning on going to some art shows or exhibits this summer, this spring, give us a call. We'd like to have you join the conversation. We'd like to hear your feedback. Tell us what's going on with the art scene in your community as well. All you have to do is pick up that phone and call 1-800-996-2848. 1-800-996-2848. We'll have more with Joseph Sanchez when we come back from this break and our other guests. Monday kicks off a week of action for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Relatives Awareness. Dozens of locations are hosting rallies, marches, panel discussions, and other events to acknowledge the unbalanced statistics when it comes to justice for Indigenous victims of violence. We'll check on the status of improving those statistics on the next Native America Calling.
Support from Dartmouth College hosting its Tribal Leadership Academy July 28th to August 2nd in New Hampshire. Up to 25 new or appointed tribal government leaders and a group of experienced presenters will consider intergovernmental relations, economic development, health care, natural resources, and tribal law and order. Dartmouth College will cover the travel and attendance costs. Application available at dartmouthtriballeadershipacademy.com. Application deadline is May 16th, 2025.
Souls can be bought and forget about when I migrated to the kingdom of Hawaii. Opened up my mind to the idea of strength.
You're listening to Native America Calling. We're talking with artists whose work is featured in current art exhibits. Are there Native art exhibits you're excited to visit this year? Any artists you'd love to see? Give us a call. Let us know. 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. One of our guests today, Joseph Sanchez, he is an artist and co-curator of The Ancestors Are Talking exhibition at the White Museum of the Canadian Rockies. And Joseph, give us a little bit more of a description of the pieces that you have in the exhibit. Again, we're on radio, so people can't see these works in person or even on the website. Maybe they're just driving down the road and they're listening and they're enjoying this conversation. Give us a little bit of visuals for those folks.
Okay, first I want to just acknowledge all the members, Jackson Beardy, Eddie Covenis, Carl Ray, then Daphne Ojig, Norval Morrison, and Alex Janvier. So in this show, the didactics are the words of these artists. I didn't write stuff about what I thought their paintings meant. I used their own words. So when you look into the show, you're going to, The Ancestors Are Talking is the title of my own painting that my co-curators selected for the exhibition. And it's an 8-foot painting of a woman rising from the New Mexico landscape, basically Mother Earth, receiving knowledge from the ancient ancestor, also a woman. And the male sections are sitting quietly, listening. I believe in my work is all about the promotion of women's, the unity of the world is only going to come through women and the nurturing element that we see in that. So my paintings themselves are about that, about women, spirits rising. I see this as a call. There's an 8-foot piece of a figure rising into the ethers of the world. It looks like water rising and kind of reaching out, that the spirits need to rise from, the indigenous spirit needs to rise again from our thousands of millennia of time. So the show is kind of bringing that forward, that the visual of a human being, the human spirit, the human indigenous spirit rising and returning to the earth to help kind of settle things down and bring unity to the planet.
Joseph, when did you paint this piece?
These are my paintings are all from either late 2024 or 2025.
Mm-hmm. I find it fascinating.
Fresh off the wall from Santa Fe.
Okay. Well, let's talk about, you've got strong roots in northern New Mexico, the White Mountain Apache Reservation. How did you become such an important part of Native art representation in Canada?
My destiny to meet these artists. I think we were spiritually connected, and it happened to be just the seven of us. Many artists were invited to be a part of this group, and it turned out to only be the seven. And I think we were just connected in the other dimensions. So we all have that ability to look past what Daphne called the invisible line and see something else. And I think Native people are like that. We have this ability to transcend this dimension. You know, we've added now, this group has added the word spiritual back into the canon of contemporary art, because nobody ever would describe work as being spiritual. Today they will, after looking at all this work and the shows at the National Gallery. The word spiritual now is, when they describe this work, there's a spiritual element to it.
Joseph, thank you so much. And Dawn as well, really appreciate you both coming on the show and sharing all this information with regard to the Ancestors Are Talking exhibition at the White Museum of the Canadian Rockies. There's a website, white.org. You can check out some of the work on display online. Let's now talk with our next guest, Kayla Wanity. She is a multidisciplinary artist in a spring 2025 Institute of American Indian Bachelor of Fine Arts graduate. She's a member of the Meskwaki tribe. Kayla, you are graduating. You're a senior in fine arts. what are you focused on as this academic journey for you comes to a close? And also, congratulations, by the way.
Hello, yes, thank you for having me. I think a lot of my focus is on like using art to continue culture. So that's a lot of ways the driving force for myself into, you know, coming to school here and graduating and now moving forward into a master's program at the University of Colorado in Boulder.
Can you give us an idea about some of the lessons you've learned, the skills you've acquired during your time at IAAA?
A lot of it comes down to the community, especially the art community. That's something that I really learned about coming here. I was not a professional artist before coming here, but now I'm working towards that. And a lot of the lessons and, you know, something that is being reiterated throughout class and throughout the community gatherings and stuff is that, you know, we're building a network, we're building our own family here, our own chosen family of different artists, different people in different mediums, and, you know, just different people going into different fields of art, and just a power in that and being able to be friends with these people and to grow together. That was something that was really big.
I read that in your bio that you didn't have a big background in art, but you had made a couple of ribbon skirts and people really liked them. And you were like, hey, maybe I've got a knack for this. Maybe I could learn some more skills. Is that still a lot of what you're doing now, is textile work and sewing? Or are you into other mediums too?
Oh, yes. So I started out as I call it a traditional artist. So I grew up doing beadwork. I grew up doing like sewing outfits for regalia, you know, putting stuff together for that. So that was my main source of creativity. Kind of growing into that, kind of taking it into another medium where I started designing logos and like t-shirt designs for programs for my tribe and different events that were going on. You know, I designed a couple of shirts where I started realizing that, you know, with the purchase of those designs, I could actually create this into something where I could become more into a professional artist. So that was what led me to IAAA.
Tell us more about your contribution to the Rooted Voices exhibit.
Yes. So my own exhibition is called the Responsibility of Culture. So in my work, I want my viewers to really understand and to view where our teachings come from, where the ancestral teachings that come from our grandparents, our great-grandparents, you know, kind of going on to the source of it all, you know, our creator, and thinking of how our teachers, our family members pass all of that to us. And then now also I wanted to have them reflect on our own positions of that learning, of that knowledge, and passing it on to younger generations. So my work is, you know, causing a lot of reflection in my viewers and, you know, our place in the world now and how we can use that to further the life of our culture as Indigenous people.
And of course, you are a citizen of the Meskwaki tribe, based there in the state of Iowa. Tell us more about your culture and how you represent it through your artwork.
Yes. So, I really hold true to like the aesthetic of my people. I use appliques, I use florals, I depict my homelands in my work, and I really transform it in a way where it can be viewed by people outside our community and it can be understood, but still holding true to our aesthetic, our beliefs in those images.
And for someone who comes to the exhibit and they see some of your pieces, what do you want them to feel? What do you want them to take away from seeing your artwork, Kayla? Or, yeah.
In my own exhibition, I really want people to feel motivated. I want to activate their responsibility. I want them to feel like, you know, geez, yeah, we did receive all of this from our teachers, from our grandparents, from our ancestors, and now it's our turn to share it, to pass it on. And I always refer back to, there's a saying where it's, you know, we are our ancestors' biggest dreams and hopes and prayers. But I think a lot of people forget that in the process, we are future ancestors. So, you know, it's our turn to dream, to hope, and to pray for, you know, our great-grandchildren, their great-grandchildren like that. So that's kind of the feel that I want my viewers to pull away from.
Yeah, it's easy when we're kind of caught up in the daily grind to remember those larger lessons, like you explain, and help us remember who we are and what we represent. Kayla, what about some of the other students and their artwork that's displayed? Talk about those folks.
Yes, yeah, so I'm actually really like lucky and blessed. Our cohort, the group of seniors that are in the exhibition, are all like extremely talented, and they all have messages similar to mine, where we all, you know, we all want to share our culture, we all want to represent our culture in the best possible way, but we all use it in different ways. So we have many different mediums in our exhibition, where we have sculptural pieces, we have ceramic pieces, we have ledger art, we have anime, like comic drawings, and we also have digital sketchings. You know, the vast majority of what's going on here is so beautiful that it's just an awesome show, and I'm glad for everyone who's doing it. There's a lot of topics that are being touched on, as well as the importance of the matriarchy and how water is connected to that and how that moves forward a culture. But then on the other end of the spectrum, we have mental health and how it helps through culture, and how culture can be used to help heal any mental ailments that we have. And then on another spectrum, we have how art can, you know, really help in mental health and care for yourself, you know. Along with that, you know, we have a little political pieces on how the Haudenosaunee view the president, and then their own title for him as a town destroyer. So it's the stories that are being shared in our work is vast, but it's done in the most beautiful ways. And yeah, I'm just blessed that, you know, my cohort is filled with talented people.
Mm-hmm. And that president you referred to, I think that was George Washington, right? That the Haudenosaunee referred to as the town destroyer.
Yes. Yep. So there's a piece in here with that in the painting.
All right. What always fascinates me, Kayla, about art is you folks are so gifted with regard to just your talents, but there's also the whole business side of being an artist. And what have you learned about that as a student at IAIA, the business of art?
So the business of art, it's a very delicate thing. And so there's a lot of considerations that go into it. So even working with a gallery, say we take our work to the gallery to then be sold, we have to conduct ourselves and like think about the way they represented us when we represent ourselves. So it becomes more of a tie-in almost. So it's definitely very interesting, and it's very eye-opening. The kind of, I don't want to call them limitations, but like the guidelines of working as an artist, but also like the opportunity. So there are times where there are different things, business side, that will come and bring or put you in a place that is totally outside of what you thought could have been like a reachable goal.
So there's definitely some difficulties in it, but there are so many positivities and opportunities that can come from it.
And what are your plans for the future, Kayla? Now you're graduating. Are you going to stay around the Southwest? Are you thinking about going back to the Midwest? Where are you headed?
Yes. So I will be going to a master's program in Colorado, the University of Colorado in Boulder. That's my next immediate step in August. But directly after graduation, I'm going home to Iowa. I'm going to spend time with my family. I'm going to prepare. So I'm having a special and a giveaway that I want to do for my community and for my family. Just to give thanks. I received a lot of support from my home community and from my family, and I'm just appreciative to them. So I wanted to do something like that before I continue my next step.
Are there any other Meskwaki students at IAIA?
Not currently. There have been a couple. I like to think that we all come one at a time just to have a little special us moment. But I had a little relative. Well, I call him my little big relative. He was here last year and he went home for a bit. And then also one of my relatives came maybe a couple years before me, but we all kind of come sparsely.
Well, Kayla, thank you for coming on the show and sharing your involvement with the Rooted Voices exhibit, as well as your classmates who also participated. And good luck in the future, okay? We're rooting for you. Keep in touch. Colorado Master's program you're going to be at. You bet. You bet. We're going to take another short break. We're going to come back and we're going to continue our conversation about art exhibits this spring and this summer. We have another guest on the line, Cassidy Plyler, who is joining us from Tribal Lands of the Catawba Nation. So stay with us. We're going to start that conversation here in just a moment. And if you'd like to join the conversation, just give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. 1-800-996-2848. You know how it works. That connects you with our studio in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And we have producers waiting, standing by for your call. So what are you waiting for? Join the conversation. 1-800-996-2848 or just 1-800-99-NATIVE. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Challenges to societal harmony abound. Trauma, depression, addiction. In Native communities, these challenges affect nearly everyone. The Native American Social Work Studies Institute educates social workers for careers to address the needs of Native communities. You can be part of the solution as a peer support worker, community health worker, or a counselor with culturally relevant training from the Native American Social Work Studies Institute. Info at online.nmhu.edu. New Mexico Highlands University supports this show. Did you know that one person can save up to 8 lives and heal dozens more through the gift of organ and tissue donation? Give hope to thousands of people across the U.S. waiting for a life-saving organ transplant. Learn more about the power of organ, eye, and tissue donation with Life Center Northwest, the organ procurement organization serving all of Alaska, at lcnw.org. That's lcnw.org. Support for this program is provided by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles the issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. What AARP does might surprise people. For more information and resources, including member benefits, AARP advocacy, and more, go to aarp.org. Support provided by Alaska Growth Capital. The Aleut Marketplace is now open. Aleut Corporation shareholders and registered descendants are eligible. Applications are available at alaskagrowth.com under Marketplace. Skuktash,
For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods, tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Omnye.
You're tuned in to Native America Calling. Still time to join our conversation about current and upcoming Native art exhibits. If you are an artist or your work is featured in a show or an exhibit, tell us about it. Give us a call. We're at 1-800-996-2848. Or maybe you can tell us about a Native art exhibit you're working on as a curator. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us now from Rock Hill, South Carolina, on tribal lands of the Catawba Indian Nation, we have Cassidy Plyler. She's an artist and the cultural public program specialist for the Catawba Nation. She is also a Catawba citizen. Cassidy, hello, and welcome to Native America Calling.
Hi, how are you?
We're
in the Catawba language, Tanake.
Thank you. Thank you for that greeting. I appreciate it. Let's talk about this exhibit. It's at the Hickory Museum of Art. It's in Hickory, North Carolina. It includes the Catawba Nation. It's titled, I Am Indigenous Ancestral Memory. Tell us about ancestral memory and how it's featured in this exhibit.
All right. So, you know, ancestral memory is just talking about the memory we have of our ancestors embedded in our DNA, right? So that's, for example, I like to use the instances when people return back to their communities. For me, I grew up on the reservation here and was lucky to be immersed in some of our culture from a young age. But I have friends and colleagues that just recently moved back to tribal lands and first time picking up our traditional crafts and, most notably our pottery tradition that is about 12,000 year old tradition that we still have, and they pick it up and it's like they never missed anything from growing up here. And that's that ancestral memory that we have embedded in our DNA as Indigenous people, regardless of what nation we come from. And being able to showcase that in this platform, with Crocheta Pueblo artist Virgil Ortiz and his story, he came to the Hickory Museum, and before he was involved in saying that he would agree to do the exhibit there, he wanted to reach out to the Indigenous people who had once stewarded the land there. And Hickory is in the ancestral land of the Catawba Nation. And so he reached out to us, and we made this connection to figure out what could we do to share both of our stories of this ancestral memory that we have and tell our stories together. And pottery is that joint effort that we have. Our pottery tradition is not as well known, but within Indigenous communities, it is, and it's celebrated in different museums, but we don't ever have the opportunity to share the story that goes with it. Like, our art is on display, but our story isn't there with it. People often are like, well, who are the Catawba? It's a really small tribe in South Carolina that were the only federal tribe in the state. And for me, from the 90s growing up here, it's been my life's passion to just tell our story wherever I could. And so that's what this is telling that story.
Well, Cassidy, I know exactly who your people are, the Catawba Indian Nation. I live not too far down the road in Asheville, North Carolina, so I'm very familiar with you folks in your homelands. I'm also looking at the website right now for the Hickory Museum of Art, and there are some beautiful pictures of Catawba pottery. It's absolutely remarkable. Tell us more about the pieces you have in the exhibit.
So I have just a few small pieces, and our pottery is made in the traditional way. So I went and helped dig the clay from some of our ancestral sites and processed it, and using coil method and these old techniques that have been passed down, was able to create one of my styles is just this basic picture with a small turtle effigy on the side. A lot of the Catawba pottery work has animal effigies associated with our work as a woodland people. You know, animals are always around us. Animals kind of help tell our story. Those are our siblings, our friends, our guidance, you know, and so we include them on our art. And then I also have what we call a Cupid jug on display, and this is looks like a canteen where it had one side would be a bigger spout for you to drink out of, or a smaller spout to drink out of, and the other side would have a bigger spout for you to refill this canteen. And there is a hole on the top to where traditionally you would have it lash through a strip of leather, and you tie it on the tree near where you're working. You carry this canteen with you wherever you go. Today we have water bottles, so we don't have to carry that around, but just having these traditional shapes that we use, and then my work is alongside of some of my father's work and some of my great aunt, my grandfather's sister, who taught me and my father pottery. And so we all have that all together, and I think that is great. And there's also just this giant photo of myself. I'm one of the featured artists, so we have this massive portrait along with our biography and our story about who we are and where we learned our pottery tradition, or where we learned this traditional skills from, and alongside some of our work.
Well, tell us more about your aunt who taught you how to make pottery.
So my aunt Lib, I accredit her for so much in my life. Elizabeth Plyler was her name. She passed away 2 years ago. She was 95 years old when she passed, and she was still very active and learning things. And so she grew up and was born in a time that was very different here, where pottery was a livelihood. Like, we had to make our pottery to survive. And so she learned from her mother, who and passed down, which were some of the first people photographed making Catawba pottery in the early 1900s, late 1800s. And so she picked these skills up, and she would tell me these stories of going and trading pottery in the local towns nearby to try to get money, or just food, flour, sugar, or even sometimes cloth so that they can make clothing. And so she held on to these skills, and she was able to nurture that connection with my uncles and my dad, who was much younger than his siblings. And he would go out, you know, around town while they were building the towns around us, and he would find these old sites and try to dig clay and do whatever he could, because my aunt would send him out and say, well, this is what you need to do. And then as we came along, my dad was working with her, and I was about two or three years old, my first time making pottery, and I'm going over here, and this was my first encounter with sandpaper, was at my Aunt Liv's house. And, you know, I was like, oh, this stuff would be awesome as a scratcher. And before they could tell me no, they turned around, and I'd done rubbed my face with this sandpaper. And it's like, I wasn't, you know, that's my first story of learning as a young age. I was that little where I didn't even know some of these tools we were using. But my aunt, you know, her age, she fostered that in me. And she also was involved in keeping some of our traditional dance, and would travel, you know, even during the time when you really weren't supposed to. They had these small group of people that would travel up to different states and sell pottery and then perform some traditional dancing. And she was one of those kids that was included in that stuff. And so she fostered that in me, because she called me Missy, and she's like, Missy, make sure you hold on to this stuff, because one day it'll be important. As a kid, I was like, oh, well, I don't, okay, whatever, Aunt Liv, you know. But now, in my 30s and teaching the children today, and what I'm able to do for our people, I'm very grateful for that. Because I know not many people here in our community had that same experience. Being on the East Coast and being in South Carolina, you know, Catawba have been encountered by European people since the 1500s, and the 1700s really have been trying to assimilate us into this society, to where we are assimilated in a sense that we have lost a lot but there are these small things that are here that are so very rich that are just now having that chance for the story to be told on this bigger platform.
And Cassie,
this does that.
Yeah, it really sounds like it does. And you know what I find really intriguing about this exhibit is here you are, you're describing the Catawba tradition of pottery that dates back thousands of years, you know, some of these ancient skills. And then at the same time, you mentioned Virgil Ortiz from Cochinita Pueblo in New Mexico. And he's renowned for his futuristic type of art, you know, looking forward and some of these like modern themes. So how do those two elements blend together? Here you have some of this very old traditional perspective with pottery, and then you have this new futuristic perspective with someone like Virgil Ortiz. I'm curious how that all relates together and comes together for the exhibit there in Hickory.
How it's set up in the exhibit there, it's Virgil is the first thing you see on this first platform, and it goes through these futuristic stories, and it starts talking about some of the stories, and then it goes into these the beings or the characters of these stories that were their ancient beings and their mythological creatures that he uses to tell their stories. Then you go upstairs into where it starts talking about Catawba. And on the floor, it has an image of the Catawba River, and along the river, you see the works of pottery, you see images of the people and the stories we tell. And like I was saying previously, a lot of animals and are used, and effigies are used in our pottery. And so when talking with Virgil, we were trying to figure out, I helped curate this exhibit with Hickory and our artisan development coordinator here, Joanna Henry, at the Cultural Center on the Catawba Nation. We were able to kind of figure out how can we relate this, because like we're like, yeah, this is very futuristic, and we're like, well, this is the old traditional style. But what we did was these effigies and the stories that the pottery tells, right? That's how we were able to make that connection. And so some of the beings of his stories look like some of the animal effigies that have been created by people, like frogs and these different versions of animals portrayed by our citizens look similar to some of these creations that Virgil has taken from these old stories of his people. And so that's where we found that connection there, and just built on that story of connection using characterization or what story the pottery itself actually tells.
Cassidy, there's a website, hickoryart.org. It's the website of the Hickory Museum of Art. Is that the best place for listeners to go to learn more about this exhibit, or are there other websites as well that they could visit?
That would be the best place, the Hickory Museum of Art, to visit their website to learn about the exhibit itself. Or I know Virgil, his art page, he has some of that on his personal story. But if you wanted to learn about Catawba, you can also visit the Catawba Nation or catawbaculture.org and learn about Catawba Nation and the things that we have here. But that exhibit specifically is through Hickory. And right. We have hopes that it will foster this connection with Virgil. I know we plan to join the two, because Pueblo and Catawba pottery are these old forms of pottery in the United States. And so we have these dreams to join the forms together. And so I have hopes to work with artisans here, if not myself, maybe one of my colleagues, and work with Virgil to create a piece that we can then join together that would be Catawba Pueblo and Catawba pottery telling a story together. And that's because of this exhibit in Hickory, that connection has been fostered and created.
That's exciting. And Cassidy, yeah. How about you? Are you on social media?
I am on social media, Cassidy Plyler. You can follow me on Instagram, Facebook, different things.
Okay. And it sounds like maybe you do some teaching as well. Do you work with new potters?
I work some with new potters, but I because I was immersed in culture here on the reservation and because of my family, I actually know a lot of traditional art and traditional practices, like some of our songs, our dances, and I'm really good at learning skills quickly and then teaching them to other people. So that's what I do. Besides teaching pottery, I'm also helping teach and revitalize river cane basketry and river cane work and traditional weaponry with my dad with traditional blowguns. I also help traditional dance and some of our stomp dances, and I teach a lot of the youth here our dances and coordinate our festival that we have, and then I also learn some of the language. So I learn a lot, I teach a lot, and then I go out to the public and I teach about our history to tell our story in these places too because of my job here at the Cultural Center.
All right, Cassidy, thank you for joining the show. Really appreciate you spending time with us and educating our listeners. Best of luck going forward.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Hello and kate.
All right. Unfortunately, we're out of time, so we're going to have to wrap up this conversation now with our artist, but I want to thank everyone who joined today's conversation. Cassidy Plyler, Kayla Wanati, Joseph Sanchez, and Dawn Sanders Dahl. Join us again on Monday when we will be noting progress and setbacks in solving justice disparities for missing and murdered Indigenous relatives. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Our producers are Andy Murphy and Sol Traverso. Joe Thompson is the UNM Local News Fellow. Marino Spencer is the engineer. We had help this week from Roman Garcia. Sho McPoland is the digital producer. Nola Daves Moses is the distribution director. Bob Peterson is the network manager for Native Voice One. Clifton Chadwick is our national underwriting sales director. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor for National Native News. Charles Sather is our chief operations officer. The president and CEO of Kwanic Broadcast Corporation is Jacqueline Salee. Have a safe weekend. I'm Sean Spruce.
Support from Dartmouth College, hosting its Tribal Leadership Academy July 28th to August 2nd in New Hampshire. Up to 25 new or appointed tribal government leaders and a group of experienced presenters will consider intergovernmental relations, economic development, healthcare, natural resources, and tribal law and order. Dartmouth College will cover the travel and attendance costs. Application available at dartmouthtriballeadershipacademy.com. Application deadline is May 16th, 2025.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Mm-hmm.